It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Automated red light cameras work by snapping pictures of a driver's license plate when running a red light, and the vehicle owner is then sent a ticket. There is renewed discussion in Milwaukee about whether these types of cameras could be legalized and make the roads perhaps safer to help address reckless driving. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wen, who is a senior research transportation engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Wen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So Milwaukee officials, they're calling for our state legislature to allow that city to use automated cameras to catch drivers running red lights. How widespread are red light cameras now?
So based on our tracking of public information, including the media sources, currently over 300 communities in the U.S. in 23 states and the District of Columbia use red light safety cameras.
And does that ebb and flow, or has that been increasing over time?
Well, there have been, if you look at the over time, the trend, yes, the number has been increasing.
In cities. But, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So, yeah, there has been, in these communities, some communities turned on these red light safety cameras, some communities turned off these safety cameras. But the number have been fluctuating, but hopefully overall, more communities are going to use these cameras.
So step back and explain for us, if you would, how are red light cameras different from traffic sensor cameras?
So red light cameras, so these camera systems, they are connected to the traffic signal, and they use sensors typically under the pavement, just before the stop line or the crosswalk, to monitor the vehicle speeds. If the sensor detect that a vehicle is running red light, and then the camera system would take a picture of the vehicle's license plate, depending on the state law. And then someone will reveal the evidence, and then if they decide that, okay, this vehicle runs red light, a citation ticket will be sent to either the owner or the driver, depending on the law.
Okay, either the owner or the driver. Do you have any idea how cities use the revenue that's generated off of these camera tickets?
The best practice is to allocate the revenue from the red light safety cameras to transportation safety programs. So that's what we think a good, well-run red light safety camera should do.
So transportation, transportation safety programs. Can you give like an example?
For example, there are more U.S. communities are have their Vision Zero plan, and they have this long-term plan to improve the road safety and the safety for all the road users in the community. And so this is an example of road safety where the revenue of the red light safety camera could be put into.
And Vision Zero meaning that getting down to no deaths from traffic accidents. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Wen Hu is with us, senior research transportation engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, as we talk about the research behind automated red light cameras. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Wen, are red light cameras effective at ticketing drivers who are driving unlicensed vehicles?
I'm not sure how this processing works in this situation, but I'm sure there's a way to process this kind of situation. But yeah, I'm not familiar with the process.
As you look at the research that's been done on these cameras, how effective are red light cameras at improving public safety?
So numerous research, including the research by us and by researchers from other universities and organizations, have documented that relay safety cameras are pretty effective in reducing both relay violations and relay running crashes.
Pretty effective. What are they best at, and where are the shortcomings?
So we have done several researches. So for example, a more recent study we did in Arlington, Virginia, the study found significant reductions in violations 1 year after the program started ticketing. And another interesting finding of this study is that the reductions in relay running violations were larger the longer after the light had turned red. So that's when the violations are more likely to result in crashes. And we also did research to examine the effects of the relay safety cameras on crashes. A recent study by us. So in this study, we compared fatal crash rates in large U.S. cities with cameras to large cities without relay safety cameras. And we found significant reductions in fatal relay running crashes, as well as all type of fatal crashes at signalized intersections. It's very effective in reducing relay running and the crashes
Are there any
related.
areas that these cameras fall short? Things that need to improve for this type of mechanism to be at intersections?
So there are some studies which report increases in rear-end crashes at intersections with relay safety cameras. But these rear-end crashes, they are way less severe than the right-angle crashes, which are the one of the most severe crashes at intersections, and it's the target type, crash type of these relay safety cameras. So the net safety benefits are still positive.
And I wonder too, because in 2018, the study by Case Western Reserve University finds that red light cameras, they change the types of accidents that happen. You mentioned rear-end collisions, but not how often accidents or injuries occurred. Is this consistent with the research that you're finding into red light cameras?
So the research finding have been pretty consistent in terms of how red light safety cameras change the red light violations and injury crashes, especially the severe or even fatal injury crashes at signalized intersections. So even though some studies like the one you mentioned found increases in some less severe crash types, such as rear-end crashes, the net safety benefits, again, they are positive.
Wen Hu is with us, a research transportation engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. As we discuss red light camera programs, be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some Milwaukee leaders, they're urging lawmakers to change state law to allow the use of red light and speed enforcement cameras in the city. We discuss whether these cameras could improve safety. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wen Hu is a research transportation engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Let's bring in Joe in Stevens Point. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was wondering, how can they tell who is driving the vehicle? For example, we had a company vehicle we're traveling down in Illinois where they do have red light cameras, and the driver blew a red light going into the sun. And it was very early in the morning. And anyway, the company got a ticket. How can you tell who was driving the vehicle?
Joe, thank you for that question. How can you tell when who is in that driver's seat?
I'm not sure, actually. So sometimes the speed, the red light safety cameras do not take a picture of the driver, only the license plate. I'm not sure how it depends. Again, it depends on the state law, how they handle these kind of situations.
Joe, I wonder, how did your company handle that ticket?
I think they just ate it. Mm-hmm. Nobody would admit it.
Well, thank you so much for calling in with that question. Which leads us to, you know, hearing from advocates for red light cameras arguing the technology can be a race-neutral alternative to traffic stops. But there was this 2022 analysis from ProPublica finding that traffic cameras in Chicago were disproportionately ticketing Black and Latino drivers. What can cities do to find drivers in a more fair way?
So that's a great point. First of all, it is important to act proactively to consider equitable positioning of these red light safety cameras to avoid any disproportionate use of these cameras in underserved communities. And when a locality starts to select potential sites for these red light safety cameras, geographic balance could be factored in. And then as the program goes, it's important to keep monitoring any disproportionate impact of the safety camera program and minimize the burden of penalties in these underserved communities. There actually have been some discussion on providing alternative penalty structures, which could help reducing the burden. For example, factor in the income, providing options, including reduced fines for the lower income group, and providing community service as a payment option.
Those would be some examples that might help, restore some equity, or at least, you know, trying to make sure that not a particular group is being profiled. Let's go to Chuck in Hayward. Chuck, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What would you
this
like to bring up?
Yeah. Great subject, great topic. I'm a retired law enforcement officer. I did 26 years. One of my jobs was actually traffic homicide investigation. And what I'm finding now is what we really have is a lot more inattentive driving. And that inattentive driving is subject to all the Wi-Fi, the heads up, the phones. And so the problem of people not paying attention, that person that is running that red light, and there's a like second and a half, 2 second delay that prevents cross traffic from then, you know, getting the green light. The problem is the second vehicle is not paying attention to the light. They have the vehicle in front of them. Now this one is running that light. Thus, that delay is already gone, and that's causing the side impact, which is causing a lot of problems and fatalities.
You have a bunch of trailer vehicles, if you will, going through the light, just following due course what the car in front of them is doing. What problem does this present?
So we hope that with the red light safety camera program in these communities, the driver could change their behavior. And we did some studies in several U.S. communities with red light safety cameras. And what we found that there were reductions in these crash rates, not only at intersections with these safety cameras, but also we found citywide reductions associated with the red light safety cameras. So hopefully we think part of the reason for these findings is that drivers change their behavior. They pay more attention to the environment around them, including the traffic signal. And this way, the overall crash rates will go down.
Chuck mentioned that there is that delay where the light would turn green with the opposing traffic. You know, from an engineering standpoint, what happens if cities would change the stoplight itself and extend the time the light is yellow?
So it's always important to provide adequate yellow signal timing. There are research showing that providing adequate yellow signal timing could reduce relay running violations as well as crashes. But just by providing adequate yellow signal timing alone, that may not be enough. We did a study in Philadelphia where we examined the effects of first adding about 1 second to the yellow phase and then introducing relay cameras. We found that the longer yellow signal timing reduced the relay violations by 36%. And then adding relay cameras actually further cut the relay violations by 96%.
That's interesting. When are red light cameras considered traffic calming, like a traffic calming mechanism, or are they like alongside like other, you know, calming things like speed bumps or traffic circles?
So relay camera, I know this in some U.S. communities, these relay safety cameras at intersections, they can also detect drivers who are speeding.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, if any traffic treatments which could reduce the traffic flow speeds, reduce speeding, we would say that it's traffic calming device.
Wen Hu is with us, Senior Research Transportation Engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Wen, we heard from Terry, sent an email along and says they've lived in Arizona when red light cameras were implemented and says that it was a fiasco because the lights are not at every intersection. So people simply avoid the intersection where these cameras are. And Terry also says that insurance companies use the cameras in crash cases. What can you tell us there?
So relay safety cameras, it basically works to catch people who break the rules, who break the traffic rules, just like traditional enforcement. So if a driver does not run red light, it will not be captured by the safety cameras.
Do you consider red light cameras a cost-saving tool for law enforcement?
I don't have any information in that regards, but the one benefit of these relay safety cameras is that they are monitoring the traffic 24/7. And also for the traditional law enforcement, sometimes in some situations, it's just not safe for the police officers to chase down the relay runners. And relay safety cameras, they are there. They monitor the traffic. They can capture the people, relay runners. It's safe in that aspect.
You know, there are cities like Miami and Rochester, New York, having eliminated their red light camera programs. In our last moments together, is there research about the effects of turning off these cameras?
Yes, we did a research comparing the fatal crash rates in these large U.S. cities, which discontinued their red light safety cameras, with the cities with continuous red light safety cameras. And what we found is that in the cities which discontinued the camera program, the fatal crash rates went up at signalized intersections. That's not surprising.
Wen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Wen Hu is a senior research transportation engineer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Code talkers refer to Native Americans who used their indigenous languages as a means of secret communication during wartime. A bill passed in the legislature seeks to honor Native American veterans by designating a portion of Interstate 90 as the Ho-Chunk World War II Code Talkers Memorial Highway. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen White Eagle is a representative in District 2 for the Ho-Chunk Nation. She lives in Baraboo. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So during World Wars I and II, Native American servicemen from more than 20 tribes used indigenous languages to send these coded messages to allies across the world. How did this group of people serve the country during wartime?
Well, they served them honorably, and per capita, our Native nations have served in great, huge numbers. So being a protector of land, of its people, is very important to the Ho-Chunk people and our warriors. And that does span across Indian country as well. And they're very proud of that service.
Do you know how many people served the country in this way as code talkers? What does the history say?
So that is something that we're not quite exactly sure on. Maybe the Department of Defense, you know, the United States government has more of that information, but we are still digging. And at this point right now, we know that we have 14 Ho-Chunk Nation tribal members that served as code talkers during World War II. And they have been designated as code talkers and recognized as such. However, you know, the work that it involved to find those code talkers, you know, has, I guess, a lot to do with research, coming across different codes, looking at, you know, military documents. And it takes a lot more research than just knowing who those individuals may have been. So right now, although there's 14, Kate, we think there could be upwards of in the 30s at this point.
During your testimony before lawmakers, you said that few code talkers are alive today, and we wonder if you could have a conversation with a code talker. What would you want to hear from them? What would you want to say to them?
Well, I'm very interested in how they kept the secret for so long and what challenges that had for them. Their families were never even aware that they had served this country as a code talker, which is quite interesting to know that, because our code talkers in the Ho-Chunk Nation, none of them are still here today. And their families were not even aware that they had served this country as a code talker. Now it has been brought to light, and I think it's really important to recognize that service.
They were swore to never reveal their role. What was the reason for that? Why did this have to remain a secret?
I think that's a good question, not only because I'm not sure if they were sworn to keep that a secret, or if that is something that they did because of their own conviction and knowing how important their role was. But we do know that they did not share that their whole lives, because at any time, we believe, and I think this is a good assessment, they may have been brought back into wartime to conduct the same type of service in a later war. And they didn't want to expose themselves as a code talker at any point. So their whole lives, they kept this to themselves and didn't even allow their family members to know of that.
It wasn't until the Snyder Act of 1924 that Native Americans could legally vote in the U.S. And even then, you know, many states still prevented the voting. And yet you see Native Americans volunteering in a war effort just 15 years after that. What is the tension like between indigenous groups and the American government at this time?
I can't even imagine, Kate. You're right. You know, our code talkers served in World War I, without even being recognized as citizens yet of the United States. And I think this has a lot to do with what it comes down to for Native peoples across this whole country is that the land is important. Protecting that land and protecting the people is extremely important. And if there were outside invaders, you know, attempting to take that, I think they stood for their people, making sure that they were doing something that would look ahead to future generations to protect them and protect the land on which they felt were they were caretakers. And we still do today. We're stewards of this land, and we want to make sure that it is protected for future.
We're talking about legislation recognizing Indigenous code talkers who used their native languages to send coded messages during world wars. And we have Representative Kristen White Eagle with us of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen, during the public hearing of the bill, a descendant of the code talkers testified, and when their father had passed away, they found that the military service records and showed it to their tribal veteran services officer.
And she recognized the code, and so she made a copy of it. And that's how I found out that he was a code talker. And I, when she said that, it brought back all these stories that came to my mind that through the years that I went through.
When you heard this testimony, what came up for you?
Oh, this was hard to hear because this is one of our own elders and veterans of service. His name is Donald Greengrass. And, you know, he was very interested in learning his native language, and he knew his father was an eminent speaker, and that was his only language at the time. And he knew that this was the best way to learn his language and understand a lot of our culture and customs is through our language. It's very unique. And to not be brought into that world that his father knew of the beauty of the Ho-Chunk Nation's language was very confusing, I would think, for Donald. And to be told, you know, that you're not learning this language, don't speak of it, you know, brings a lot of heartache and trauma to our people, not just because of the boarding school effect or the genocide practices of the government, but also because just understanding who you are as a person, that's very important to you to have that connection to the language. So I think it was very tough for families that weren't, I guess, aware of why they were being kept from learning the language as a Ho-Chunk Nation person. And we feel that that's possibly maybe indicative of these veterans and their service to remain committed to protect that language so that it wouldn't be infiltrated by outsiders who were using it to cause harm or danger.
And from what I gather, Native service members had a really sophisticated skill set in encoded communication techniques and, you know, along with their Indigenous language abilities. Can you speak to or talk more about these abilities that their fellow soldiers just didn't have?
Well, you know, my understanding is, you know, these secret communications occurred right on the battlefield. So I think it was a highly tense and stressful situation, and they would work in pairs. And maybe they didn't even know each other, but they knew how important their role was to protecting this country. One code talker would translate messages from English to Ho-Chunk language over a portable radio operated by a fellow code talker who would translate it back to English from their own native language. And this doesn't just affect the Ho-Chunk people. We've had Native American soldiers from 33 different tribes from across this country, three of those tribes from Wisconsin that served as code talkers during specifically World War II.
We explore the contributions of Native American code talkers with Representative Kristen White Eagle of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Be part of the discussion. You can ask a question. You can share your perspective. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore efforts to honor Ho-Chunk Nation code talkers of World War II with a proposed highway designation in Wisconsin. The Smithsonian cites hundreds of Native American servicemen used indigenous languages to send secret messages that helped the Allies to victory. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Kristen White Eagle, who's a representative in District 2 for the Ho-Chunk Nation. Let's bring in Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, good morning.
Good morning. So two of my great uncles served in World War II. One of them was a lieutenant and had the opportunity to interact with some of the code talkers. Native Americans served this country with great distinction during World War II, as well as World War I and every other war since then, because they have the warrior spirit. With the code talking, they could actually communicate in real time without having to translate using something like an Enigma machine like the Germans had. And it was a code that was unbroken. And up until it was acknowledged that they actually had served, it was a code that the U.S. government wanted to keep secret.
Marcus, thank you for bringing that history. Kristen, what would you like to add there?
Well, exactly what Marcus said. You know, what resonated with me is when he mentioned warrior spirit. That is right in line with, I think, a good sentiment of what that means to a lot of our veterans, you know, throughout Indian country, is having that warrior spirit. And that's not just a fight. That means, you know, protecting the land, protecting the people, looking at, you know, the future. So I think Marcus is right on. And that was a good history to hear, too. I learned something from what Marcus said.
The legislation aims to recognize Ho-Chunk code talkers by designating I-90 in La Crosse County and part of Monroe County as the Ho-Chunk World War II Code Talkers Memorial Highway. What has the journey been like to get recognition for code talkers in Wisconsin?
Yes, this has been in the works for a couple years now, and it was initiated, I think, mainly from Sandy Winishek, who was the Ho-Chunk Nation Veteran Service Officer. And, you know, we kind of touched on Donald Greengrass's story a little bit here about how he found the DD-214 of his father's, and he gave that to Sandy Winishek as the tribal veteran service officer. She came across this code, and she spent a lot of time looking into that and started to find that, my goodness, this code means that this person was a code talker. And she ended up initially finding 7 that were coded that way through her research and had them recognized as code talkers. Following that was another 7, probably within the last decade, that were also added. So right now we have 14 that have been designated as Ho-Chunk code talkers. And through that, most recently after, you know, this pandemic, we decided that we really want to pursue recognition for these code talkers as we heard more stories, as we heard more from the families that didn't realize that their family member was a code talker, that this secret had been kept from all the families, of the stories of the importance of, you know, our veterans and how we hold them in such high honor. We thought it was very important to look at some type of further recognition. So I did have a lot of good conversations with our state legislators in the Senate and the Assembly, who were very welcoming and very supportive of moving forward and getting this proper recognition. So thinking back to each one of those meetings with them, I just really feel grateful for their support and for listening to our stories and for supporting this, you know, in the legislature, state legislature.
Is this recognition coming too late? You mentioned how Code Talkers have passed on. And what are your reflections on the timing?
Well, can't change anything so far. I think the timing is what it is. Mm-hmm. I think this is the right time to keep moving forward. And I think the recognition is timely, and that this was the right time to do that. Unfortunately, you know, the families do not have their family member who was a co-talker with them anymore. However, this is very important, I think, for some of the reconciliation of that secrecy and knowing the importance of what their family member had done as a co-talker is still very important. So regardless of the time, I feel it's going to happen. I'm very positive that the governor will sign this bill into law, and I'm so appreciative of each state legislator that helps support this moving forward.
We're with Representative Kristen White Eagle of the Ho-Chunk Nation as we discuss Indigenous Code Talkers using Native languages to send coded messages during world wars and the recognition of them. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Eugene is here in Biola. Eugene, hi.
Good morning, Kate. In the 1970s, I was teaching on Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And at that time, the older adults spoke the language fluently, spoke the Lakota language. And they taught it at the school, and they also taught it at Syndicalistic College. Well, I took a course in Lakota language, and the problem that I ran up against was Lakota turns around. Instead of saying green house, they say house green. Mm-hmm. Completely backwards. I got through the first semester of it, and that was basically about it. I can still count to about 20 in Lakota, but I can't find an individual number. I've got to count up to it. And Pine Ridge Indian Reservation still has a Lakota speaker on a radio station.
Eugene, thank you so much for sharing that. And from what I understand, Kristen, you work daily on becoming more fluent in Ho-Chunk.
Yes. You know, it's a constant daily act of trying to incorporate phrases or words over and over, because we don't hear the language. Just as our caller was just stating, that we are suffering from losing this language. And when we think of the preservation of our native languages and who we are as people, so many of our stories are specific to being able to share that in your native language and learning about your culture and who you are as people and what's important to you. So the preservation of that language and rejuvenization of that language is important. And it's important to me to encourage that. And I think this bill also does that by recognizing that how important, you know, the Ho-Chunk language was to that Allied victory back then. And that this language, you know, they didn't pass their language skills to their family. And this, you know, probably hindered a lot of those generations on passing that language on, even to my generation. So, you know, to bring about the importance of language and native language and preserving it is very important with this bill. And it is highly connected.
I want to bring up as well, as you sat down for testimony in the public hearing, you greeted everyone in Ho-Chunk. And that was a really moving moment, that the first words out of your mouth were to greet people in the language. Can you talk about that moment?
Thank you, Kate. Yes. I didn't think about it until after I greeted everyone in Ho-Chunk. And as I started to share a little bit of my feelings with our legislators, it resonated with me that maybe that was the first time in that room that the Ho-Chunk language had been spoken, maybe not. Mm. However, to me, it was very important that I was sharing the language amongst this particular group of legislators to hear that we still have this language today. And we are working hard to revitalize that language and share that. And to me, it was very impactful to let them know that it was important to start off with what I was saying in the Ho-Chunk language, because I think this bill is very, very connected and integral to why we're doing what we're doing with this Code Talkers Memorial Highway.
In our final moments together, I want to acknowledge the State of the Tribes address and Chairman James Crawford of Forest County Potawatomi delivering that, and thinking about the Ho-Chunk Code Talkers and the services they provided. What do you hope people take away from this year's State of the Tribes address?
I hope that they take away that our tribes are a very thriving community as a whole throughout Indian country and throughout this country, that we are working hard to maintain our community ties, and that as tribal nations, that it's very important to us to maintain not just our language and to recognize our veterans, but that we serve each other. And regardless if that means within your own tribal community or within the broader community or within the state that we're in or this country, we're here to help look forward to the future and bring things, you know, bring better communities to each one of us. And I hope that people can feel that from his address today.
Kristen White Eagle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It was my pleasure.
Kristen White Eagle is a representative in District 2 for the Ho-Chunk Nation. She is serving her second four-year term and lives in Baraboo. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Billions of nocturnal migratory birds navigate North America. According to a study published in the journal Nature Communications, they must contend with the rapid growth of the artificial glow of the night sky. Thanks to Deb and Wassa for suggesting we talk more about this. Deb notices more light at night in her community.
Not just residential, but commercial. And I see it on our waterways and how it affects birds and other things. You can't see the stars at night.
You can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kyle Horton is an assistant professor at Colorado State University in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology and lead author of the study on artificial light and bird migration. Kyle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate, for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. So you and your colleagues mapped for the first time all the stopover sites in the U.S. for migratory birds. Can you first of all explain what qualifies as a stopover site, what that means?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the vast majority of migratory birds through North America will be migrating at night. So as these birds initiate that nocturnal flight, they'll lift off into the atmosphere. And we can use radars to quantify those really intense locations of where birds are picking off of our landscape. And we would consider those consistently high density areas as a migratory hotspot for stopover.
And what does this map look like? How did you put this together?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the map itself looks like sort of a hodgepodge of colors. Mm-hmm. So we delineate hotspots and reds on our maps, and areas that also get a lot of activity but aren't quite a hotspot in yellows, and more sort of other areas that are less active in grays. And these hotspots are sprinkled across the United States. And the tool that we're actually using to map these hotspots is using radar data. So the same radars that you would turn on the Weather Channel to look at a thunderstorm rolling through or other severe weather or snowfall are the same radars that we can also quantify the movement of migratory birds. The radars themselves are designed for detecting water or precipitation in the atmosphere. And from a radar perspective, those birds also look like very large rain droplets. So we're able to delineate rain versus birds and then do ecology off of that.
Oh, that's really exciting to use radar in that capacity in a whole new way.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. I think it's, you know, we've been using radar for a long time to study migratory birds, all the way dating back to World War II. But that technology has advanced sufficiently. And in the last, you know, 5 or so years, we've really been able to access this treasure trove of radar data to do ornithology, really.
Your study concludes that artificial light is a leading cause of death for birds during nighttime migration. Why are these nocturnally migrating birds attracted to artificial light?
Yeah, that's a challenging question in a way, right? We know, you know, in the last, you know, probably 100, 200 years, there's been many reports that birds, migratory birds, are attracted to lights at night. You know, originally maybe fires at night, to when we see sort of lights on buildings. We see birds flying towards communication towers. So we know that the birds are attracted to light. The actual mechanism is sort of challenging for us to unravel. We have some thoughts that it relates to their navigation and might date back deep into their evolution. Lights on a landscape are somewhat of an unnatural thing in the history of birds. The most natural light source would have been probably stars or the moon. And now we have lights sprinkled across the landscape globally. And it looks like birds are probably queuing in on some of these lights in part for their navigation. And it's causing a false cue for them to hone in on.
In this false cue, I understand that birds can circle a light and go around it and around it and around it in circles until exhaustion. What is happening there?
Yeah, so this is sometimes the, you know, the unfortunate part of these lights. So if they're not extinguished, if they're too bright on the landscape, like you mentioned, the birds they'll be attracted at long distances to the light source. They'll circle, they'll call. Sometimes they'll circle and call until they get low enough to the ground. That's where some of the most challenging issues will occur, where they could collide with communication towers. It could be buildings that have a lot of glass on them. Or they just get exhausted, right? And they're going to land and have to spend, you know, their day or days in areas that are somewhat suboptimal, right? A migratory bird landing in a downtown urban center might be challenging for that bird to then again regain its energy stores to feed, to forage, to continue that migration. And those are some of the carryover effects we expect from light pollution.
We're talking about the effects of light pollution on migratory birds. Kyle Horton is an assistant professor at Colorado State University. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Kyle, your study determined that light pollution attracts songbirds more than agricultural lands, precipitation, and temperature. What about the impacts of climate change on bird behavior?
Yeah, that's a great question. Something we think a lot about is how different weather patterns might be changing migration on seasonal or annual basis, and then thinking across longer time series about climate change. And what we have dug into in some of these studies is that we actually see some of the timing of migration is changing under climate change, especially in the spring. In some of these warmer seasons, we're seeing that the birds are showing up earlier. It doesn't appear that they're showing up earlier enough to match the changing seasons, but migration patterns certainly are changing. And again, we see that whether it's from studies like this or anecdotal observations from bird watchers or folks seeing different birds showing up at their bird feeders at different times of the year.
So light pollution can also confuse birds, as you've been talking about. How is this affecting the ability of birds to reach nesting and foraging grounds?
Yeah, so on the most grave example, right, is that the birds are going to potentially collide with something that ultimately kills the bird, right? So right there, the migration is halted for that bird. We also think about some of the more diffuse issues of light pollution. As we mentioned, right, the birds circle, they call, they burn up unnecessary energy because they're attracted to lights. And that might carry over to the breeding grounds or potentially the wintering grounds as well. So now this bird has to make up time. It has to make up foraging efforts to get to the breeding grounds to raise young. It's really competitive often on the breeding grounds for these birds. So showing up days late, a week late, can really have important consequences for the success of that bird to raise a nest of younglings that will, you know, start their own migration. So there's a number of carryover effects that we expect from light pollution. Measuring it is quite challenging, but studies like this start to point to those issues and the scale of the issue.
Looking for solutions here, Deb in Wausau is wondering if motion sensors could help, only, you know, turning on a light when it's triggered.
Yeah, that's a great point and a great suggestion. That's certainly something that we advocate for. Reducing lights where and when we can, when we feel safe in doing so, is really important. Having motion sensors on exterior lights becomes really important and is a good messaging strategy to just have the lights on when we need and want it. Other things that we try to message is, you know, do we need the light to be as bright as it is? So if we need the light, can we dim the light and still get the same use? And then we often talk about the color of the light as well, right? We're probably all quite familiar, maybe as we're driving into work, with, you know, seeing headlights on cars with that really bright white to blue light.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be somewhat worse for most animals. So if we can get more towards some of those warmer colored lights, the yellows to oranges, that seems to also reduce some of the negative effects that we get from light pollution in ecology.
And John from Milwaukee is asking just that, whether it does make any difference, the color of the light. And John's heard that red might be less harmful than other colors to birds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we see this a lot in collisions at communication towers as well, with birds potentially colliding with those towers. Studies have shown that a blinking red light on those communication towers can reduce collisions. So we sort of move that forward and think, okay, red lights probably have the least impact on attraction, at least for migratory birds. And that seems to hold true for many other taxa as well. So red light, getting more towards those warmer color lights to red, will be beneficial.
Kyle Horton is a conservation biologist at Colorado State University, an aspect of his research focusing on how artificial lights can affect migratory bird patterns. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the growing effects of light pollution on migratory birds. And in recent days, a United Nations wildlife meeting is offering new global guidelines to address the impacts of light pollution on migratory species. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. Kyle Horton is an assistant professor at Colorado State University researching avian flight strategies and artificial light. Let's go to Crash in Milwaukee. Hi, Crash. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Thanks for this discussion. Fascinating subject. I'm curious, do other wavelengths of light, would they be helpful, like infrared or ultraviolet, or would they actually do more harm?
Yeah, that's a great point. So it's certainly an area, I think, of research that we're interested in, whether or not infrared or ultraviolet would be beneficial, I think, is actually an open question. So I think that's in part what, you know, we will be looking at going into the future. We're actually running current studies of trying to figure out what causes the most or least attractive just based on wavelength. So we haven't jumped into ultraviolet or infrared, but we're looking at sort of within red, blue, white, and yellow lights and seeing what the attraction looks like. So, you know, stay tuned for future updates on that. But that's a great thing that we're often thinking about. Great question.
Developing research area. I want to turn to the Chicago mass die-off tragedy last October, about 1,000 birds being killed by colliding with McCormick Place, Lakeside Center in Chicago. How unusual was that incident?
Yeah, so, you know, last fall we had around 1,000 birds collide in a single morning with the windows of McCormick Place Convention Center. That event is the one of the largest, if not the largest, collision events in the last 40 years.
Wow.
So it's certainly atypical in that sense, but each season, you know, there's events in the mornings where we're getting, you know, low hundreds of dead birds. So we do see some of these big mortality events at that building and other buildings around the U.S. and globally as well. So it's uncommon in the sense of the magnitude, but common in that we do have many collision events per season.
Have there been any prevention efforts that have resulted from these mass die-offs of birds like this one in Chicago?
Yeah, so it's a little unfortunate sometimes that, you know, the action that we see moving forward is often spurred on by, you know, a collision event like this. But, you know, some of the positive outcomes of this, you know, if you could think of it in that context, is that the convention center has agreed to do some mitigation, turning off some of their lights when they're not necessary, closing the blinds when necessary. We know that there's a strong relationship between when the lights are on in that convention center and how many birds we see dying at the windows. So we can really reduce mortality, you know, sometimes halving, if not creating more dramatic reductions in bird collisions, just by turning off the switch and reducing those lights. So there have been some measures and agreements to reduce light pollution on that building, and we know that that will translate into fewer bird collisions.
Your research is supported by NASA. Why is the U.S. Space Program interested in the threats facing migratory birds?
Yeah, that's a good point to raise. So NASA does many things, right? And we know them for lots of reasons, but we probably often don't think about them, you know, for interest in studying migratory birds. But the relationship here is that we can use data sets that NASA generates at very large scales, things like land cover or the temperatures on Earth's surface. And we know that there's an integral relationship, a strong relationship between where birds are on the landscape in what the land cover looks like, whether it's forested or agriculture. So we can use these vast data sets that NASA generates from their space-based satellites, and we can link it with observations of migratory birds. So that's been a really exciting thing, and that's what's allowed us to map bird migration stopover at such large scales from, you know, as we say, coast to coast, border to border across the lower 48 states. We can map where and when birds will be flying on a given night or a given season.
And on a given night, then, it can also be communicated in the weather forecast. I noticed in your presentation you said there are some stations that if it is a particularly acute migratory time, it will be part of their weather forecast. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we run a project called Birdcast. You can see live migration movements and forecasts at birdcast.info. We make forecasts during spring and fall. They go live on March 1st and go through the mid-June, start back up in August for fall migration. And we make forecasts of where we expect some birds to be migrating. Just like you would tune on, you know, a weather forecast to see what the temperature is, You can pull up Birdcast and see what the bird migration forecast will be. How many birds will be flying over Milwaukee or Chicago or whatever your city of interest is? You can see how many birds we expect to be flying, what we think the makeup of those birds will be, what species will be flying throughout that season. So there's just a tremendous amount of information that we now have at our disposal to talk about migratory birds. And we can also use those forecasts to try to say, okay, this is one of the big nights of migration coming up. If we could reduce light pollution on this night, this would have a really positive benefit for the success of all the migratory birds that sort of we know and love and want to see, you know, get to their breeding grounds.
And that's at BirdCast. Kyle Horton, assistant professor at Colorado State University, as we talk about the effects of light pollution on migratory birds. You can join with your question at 800-642-1234. Kyle, in recent days, the United Nations released its first ever State of the World's Migratory Species Report, and the report identifies light pollution as a growing threat to many migratory species. How much research has been done on the effects of night pollution on other wildlife, you know, outside of birds?
Yeah, so this is certainly a growing field. You know, birds is just one element. So when we try to talk about light pollution, we're advocating for the reduction of light pollution for all wildlife. So whether this is movements of deer on the landscape or bats on the landscape, or, you know, where I'm, you know, out west, mountain lions and their movements is all influenced by light pollution. A tremendous amount of interest in invertebrates or insects and how they're attracted and could be causing population declines for some species that they're strongly attracted to light pollution. So it's a pretty widespread phenomena. And we also just, you know, in alignment with recommendations there, right? Light pollution is one of these things that if we change it tonight, we'd have a positive impact tomorrow. And that's not true of most ecological concerns. So we can have really positive benefits by reducing light pollution immediately.
Do you find that it's a positive step for the United Nations to move in this direction to acknowledge light pollution? And, you know, what are the repercussions maybe globally about light pollution?
Yeah, I think it is the right step. I think awareness is a big part of it. You know, we've grown accustomed to lights at night. It is certainly a resource that we have. And we need to frame it in the sense of what are some of the negative consequences. I often say, you know, if I take a can of paint and I walk to my local stream and I dump it in there, it's very clear that's pollution. But if I leave my porch light on all night or a skyscraper leaves really bright lights, we don't often view that as that same form of pollution. But for some organisms, it is affecting them in a negative way. So we want to just reframe how we think about lights to some extent.
Kyle, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Kyle Horton is an assistant professor at Colorado State University in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation. And we continue the discussion with the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The glow from city centers is a magnet for migratory birds. We learn about artificial light at night and other hazards that migrating birds encounter in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen Etterhale is chair of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership and former executive secretary of the Madison Audubon Society, now known as the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance. Karen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Scientists are finding that North America has lost, you know, 3 billion birds in recent years. What has been the response among Wisconsin birders to this decline in bird populations?
Well, this is really a serious issue, and a lot of us who have birded a long time have noticed in many cases that our birds are a lot fewer, including a lot of our songbirds, but across the board, that's true. In March of last year, we held a statewide conference to address the issue and tried to inspire people to do more for birds, to bring birds back, which was the theme of our conference.
What were some of the ideas that came up to bring birds back?
there's a lot of problems that we can address. The biggest one is habitat, and that was addressed by your previous speaker, looking at stopover sites. So that, but it's across the board. So one thing that people can do is to start planting or replacing their plantings with native species. Those support all the insects that most birds feed to their young in almost all cases. And the plants that are not native have not evolved with the insects that they need here in Wisconsin. So that's one of the biggest ones is habitat.
Habitat, yes.
But carry on, yes. We didn't want to look at all the different hazards to birds in Wisconsin because that would be a little bit overwhelming, and we can just mention some of those here this morning. But the other two we wanted to focus on were windows, which also relates to your previous speaker. Almost everyone has a window at their home that has caused deaths to birds. So we really tried to promote addressing just at least one of your windows. We had sample kits that you could put on your windows. We've provided information about all the ways you could address one, and maybe you need to address more than one. But if all the people that attend this and want to do this, we will be saving a lot of birds.
What can someone do to their picture window that looks out to a tree? How would you change the window?
The picture windows are a little harder because they're so big, mm-hmm. but you can address those too. The most important thing is to try to put the treatment on the outside of your window. What happens is the birds, you have to think like a bird, right? So what the bird sees is not the glass, it's the reflection, and it looks like habitat. Mm-hmm. Or they don't see the glass at all and they run into it. So you want to break up that reflection. One of the treatments is called feather-friendly bird collision deterrent, and it's little dots, and you put it on your window, and then it's just these small dots. They have to be placed every 2 inches in both directions to be most effective, and that has really reduced the collisions at people's homes. We were recently... had a booth at the Garden Expo in Madison, and people were telling us they did this and it actually worked.
Can you see the dots? What do they look like?
You have to, they're like little see-through pieces.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So you can see them if you look at the glass, but they're not a deterrent to looking through your picture window or your window. And you get used to those fairly quickly. So it's not much of a problem. There's also strands of strings that you can put on the outside of your window. These are all on a website, which I can give you when it's
sure.
appropriate.
You partnered with Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership did, launching the SOS, Save Our Songbirds initiative. What is that effort meant to accomplish?
Well, that was developed in conjunction with our meeting last year, and that's where the kickoff was. So SOS, Save Our Songbirds, does exactly what I'm explaining right now, is focusing on three things that you as a homeowner or even an apartment dweller can do to help birds. One is to provide some habitat by planting a native species, a shrub, even a pot of flowers for hummingbirds, addressing one of your windows, and then trying to find bird-friendly coffee to drink, which is really important because a lot of our birds travel to South and Central America, and a lot of the coffee farmers now are raising the rainforest and then planting single species coffee trees, which is not very helpful for most of our songbirds that go down to those countries. If you try to buy bird-friendly coffee like Birds and Beans, which you can order online, there's some other ones, or even organic coffee, a lot of that is grown under the rainforest canopy, which is beneficial to our migrating birds. So those are the three things. And you can go online, SOSA or Songbirds, and all of this information is right there. And you can sign up for a newsletter, too, for free.
Karen Etter-Hale is with us, chair of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership, as we talk about threats to songbirds in Wisconsin and what we can do about it. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tuli emailed and asked, Karen, what is the single most impactful thing that the average Wisconsinite can do to support birds in our state?
Again, I think it's the habitat. And even if you plant just a corner of your yard in native species, or plant a shrub, or if you want to redo your whole yard, there are numerous native landscaping and companies and nurseries in Wisconsin. Those are all, you can find those through Save Our Songbirds website or go to the DNR. And there's a whole list of them, and they're very, very helpful. I would say also talk to your local master gardener or master naturalist. There's hundreds of them all through the state, and they will also have really good information for you to get started on that. Not everybody can plant things. So, you know, like I say, try to address your window. Mm-hmm. Keep your cats indoors, please. It's better for the cats and the birds. Check to see that you maybe are a bird city. There's nearly 100 communities in Wisconsin that are bird cities. It's any kind of community, and help on their efforts.
You serve on the steering committee.
Pesticides.
Yeah. I was just going to jump in and say you serve on the steering committee of Bird City, Wisconsin. What do Bird City, Wisconsin communities do to make themselves friendlier to birds?
Bird City, Wisconsin got started to certify communities, any size, even a county or a town, to meet certain criteria to be bird friendly. So they work on habitat and education and hazards to birds. And each of them has a committee that works to increase those efforts and make their community better for birds, which is better for people too. So it's a whole range of things. There's a lot of different criteria that you can meet. And, you know, smaller communities might do one thing and a large community do another.
Let's bring in Bill in Iron River. Hi, Bill. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Yeah, I've got a patio door. Well, it's actually a three panel. And it goes out to a deck. And in the past, I'd had birds hanging around and they'd run into the windows. I got one of these model owls and I put it up on the deck rail. It's got this head that bobs in the wind. There haven't been any birds that hit that window since I put that up.
Interesting. Bill, thank you. How about an owl, fake owl, Karen?
It might be just that there's something near your window that the bird isn't seeing quite so much glass, but I know a lot of cases where people have put up an owl and the birds get used to it pretty soon. They even maybe perch on it. So don't think that unless it's moving, you have one that moves a lot. I don't think it's a really good deterrent, but in some cases maybe it would work. It's hard to deter birds from hitting windows or attacking windows, which is a different issue.
Karen Etter-Hale chairs the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership as we learn ways to protect migrating birds. Call in with a question. You can share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about how Wisconsin conservation groups have partnered to help save birds and raise awareness about the hazards that migrating birds encounter. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Karen Etter-Hale with us with the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership. Karen, a former director of Bird City, Wisconsin, Brian Lenz, convinced the builders of the Bucks Arena, Pfizer Forum, to include bird-friendly design features. That was back in 2018. How receptive are large developers to include features that reduce bird collisions?
It's and it really important that a lot of these large buildings with a lot of glass try to address the problem. It's been more successful as we go on with a lot of the architects having been trained in and or taken conferences on how to do this. There's also been a lot of development of bird-friendly glass where it's actually in the glass, so it costs a lot less than trying to address the problem afterwards.
Trying to wrap the building.
More and more, there's more and more architects and builders who are doing this, and we're trying to get some legislation passed also where new buildings or retrofit buildings will install that glass.
You mentioned that at times birds attack windows. What happens in these circumstances?
That happens often with songbirds during the nesting period. Their hormones are on, and they think they see another arrival in the glass. And especially cardinals, blue jays, robins, and others will start attacking the glass. And that's really hard to address. Mm. But you almost have to cover the entire outside of the window to or your car rearview mirrors sometimes. So that's kind of a different question than what we're trying to do here, but it's a common problem.
Well, let's bring in Terry in Green Bay now. Terry, hi.
Hi there. Good morning to you. I wanted to go back to where she was talking about those dots. What we were able to get, is this pattern of like leaves. They almost look like a maple leaf. And we were able to pick those up at our local county park or state park right in the office. And we have seen, I mean, we didn't really have a lot of that happening to us, but we've seen that that has definitely been a benefit. And she's right. You can see right through them. It just looks like a pretty decoration on the window.
Ah, okay.
So I'm really glad we found those.
And that was picked up at a park location, you said?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was a state park or a county park or, you know, a national park, but it was in Wisconsin.
Okay.
We picked it up. It was right in, you know, like the gift center where they have postcards and T-shirts and all that other stuff. It was on the counter because it really was only like an 8x10 envelope or sleeve that they had them in. And it worked out really great.
Terry, thank you for that tip. Karen, what can you tell us there?
Yeah, those also work, and they're, like she said, decorative. You can get them at, I think, at Wild Birds, too, and some of the other outdoor stores or order them. You have to put them on the outside of the glass, not the inside, and they have to be fairly close together to actually stop the birds from hitting all together, but they do help. The other thing that can help is using the washable markers or chalk on the outside of your windows, and that's, like, temporary. You can have your kids or grandkids or neighbor kids do some temporary artwork on your windows and then you can wash it off. So that would be a cheaper way perhaps to address your windows.
I have some takers for that. I wonder about the Lights Out program. You know, the Audubon Society established Lights Out decades ago in Chicago to reduce the threat of artificial lights in urban areas. How have Lights Out efforts caught on?
They're really taking off across the country, and there's quite a few in Wisconsin as well. It actually got started in Toronto, Canada, even before, long before it reached Chicago. But you can see, you can go online and see the big difference between when the lights are on and when they're off. And they don't have to be off all year. It can be just during the major migration periods of spring and fall. But it also saves a lot of money for those buildings to not have those lights on. So it's a benefit, and it helps us to see the night skies too. So it's beneficial for birds and for people as well.
There are other threats to nocturnally migrating birds. What can you tell us about, like, water and air pollution, noise?
I'm not as familiar about noise, but mm-hmm. certainly the light pollution, and then just the building, the loss of habitat along, like for instance, Lake Michigan, because when the birds are migrating at night, they're coming up from the south if it's spring, and they're over, when it becomes light in the morning, they see themselves over water over Lake Michigan, and so they head to the lake shore immediately, and they've been flying all night, so they need energy. And they come down and look for food. So having habitat right along the lakeshore and native species that provide that the energy is really important. But that's true across the board, but it often concentrates birds along the Lake Michigan lakeshore, for instance, because they're out over water sometimes when they're migrating. You can see this on radar. It's really quite interesting.
I'm sure, too, the birdcast and the technology has really brought significant accuracy and attention to when migration happens. Has that helped?
Oh, it's helped a lot. And it's really interesting because if people are watching this radar the night before, they can see that, or you can just look at the weather. If the winds are out of the south in the spring, and you know that there's probably going to be birds coming up, and you can even take off work that day. Maybe you'd go watching birds instead.
Oh, I love it. Karen Etter-Hale, chair of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership, as we talk about threats to songbirds, preservation efforts, you can call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Karen, it begs the question, where do you love to go birding and why?
Oh, I bird everywhere, but of course you can just bird outside your window. If I might make one more comment, this tomorrow and Saturday is at Prairie du Chien. It's Bald Eagle Appreciation Days, and there will be a booth there with samples of coffee and feather-friendly bird kits.
Awesome. That's so great. So what are some of the things you do when you go out birding? I would imagine you have binoculars, but, you know, walk us through what you do when you go birding.
I have the eBird application on my phone, and I turn it on as soon as I'm out the door. That tracks my distance and you know, how long I've been birding. And you can put the birds right in there, or you can do it later. It adds to the eBird Cornell Lab database, which helps birds too, because you're putting your local birds in there. And then I just enjoy walking or biking or maybe going farther afield or traveling out of state, and I just bird everywhere I am. And it all those records add up to helping researchers look at bird numbers and distributions and everything else across the world. So it's just a lot of fun. It keeps track of your records also. So it's a personal list of the birds, where you've been, how long you've birded. It's fascinating. It's just a fascination to do that. And all you need is some a program that identifies the birds or a bird book, and
you can contribute. And you can contribute to the citizen science. In our last moments together, Greg in Reedsburg is wanting to know about invasive bird species and their effects on the bird population.
The main ones we have in Wisconsin are the house sparrow, the starling, and the pigeon. And starlings and house sparrows often take over nesting native species. They'll even kill them. So you want to try to keep those out of your bird houses, or you take down your old martin house that isn't attracting martins anyway. Yeah, there's a lot of those non-native species, and it's pretty hard to deal with them. They're here. They're here permanently. They've been here for a long, long time. So we just have to deal with those. But if you're trying to get bluebirds to nest, try to keep the house sparrows out of those. Mm. Keep throwing them out.
Evicting the house sparrows. Karen, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Karen Etter-Hale is chair of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.